probably killed Kimberly Norton. We know that Yamata is out of town, and we know that his apartment has lights on. Clark found a place to park the car. Then he and Chavez went walking, first of all circling the block, looking around for patterns and opportunities in a process called reconnaissance that started at the ground level and seemed more patient than it really was. "A lot we don't know, man," Chavez breathed. "I thought you wanted to see somebody's eyes, Domingo," John reminded his partner. He had singularly lifeless eyes, Koga thought, not like a human at all. They were dark and large, but seemingly dry, and they just looked at him. Or perhaps they just pointed in his direction and lingered there, the former Prime Minister wondered. Whatever they were, they gave no clue as to what lay behind them. He'd heard about Kiyoshi Kaneda, and the term most often used to describe him was Ronin, a historical reference to samurai warriors who'd lost their master and couldn't find another, which was deemed a great disgrace in the culture of the time. Such men had turned into bandits, or worse, after they'd lost contact with the Bushido Code that had for 1,000 years sustained the elements of the Japanese population entitled to carry and use weapons. Such men, once they found a new master to serve, became fanatics, Koga remembered, so fearful of returning to their former status that they would do nearly anything to avoid that fate. It was a foolish reverie, he knew, looking at the man's back as he watched TV. The age of the samurai was past, and along with it the feudal lords who'd ruled them. But there the man was, watching a samurai drama on NHK, sipping his tea and taking in every scene. He didn't react at all, as though hypnotized by the highly stylized tale, which was really the Japanese version of American westerns from the 1950s, highly simplified melodramas of good and evil. Except that the heroic figure, always laconic, always invincible, always mysterious, used a sword instead of a six-gun. And this fool Kaneda was devoted to such stories, he'd learned over the past day and a half. Koga stood and started moving back to the bookcase, and that was all he had to do for the man's head to turn and look. Watchdog, Koga thought, without looking back as he selected another book to read. And a formidable one, especially with four others about, two sleeping now, one in the kitchen and one outside the door. He hadn't a chance of escaping, the politician knew. Perhaps a fool, but the sort that a careful man feared. Who was Kaneda, really, he wondered. A former Yakuza, probably. He didn't show any of the grotesque tattoos that people in that subculture affected, deliberately making themselves different in a culture that demanded conformity. But at the same time demonstrating conformity in a society of outcasts. On the other hand, he just sat there wearing a business suit whose only concession to comfort was the unbuttoned jacket. Even the Ronin's posture was rigid as he sat there, erect, Koga saw, himself sitting back down with a book but looking over it at his captor. He knew he couldn't fight the man and win. Koga had never troubled himself to learn any of the martial arts that his country had helped develop, and the man was physically formidable, and he was not alone. He was a watchdog. Seemingly impassive, seemingly at rest, he was, in fact, more like a coiled spring, ready to leap and strike, and civilized only so long as those around him acted in such a way as not to arouse him, and so obvious about it that you just knew that it was madness to offend him. It shamed the politician that he was so easily cowed, but cowed he was, because he was a bright and thoughtful man, unwilling to squander his one chance, if he had that much, in a foolish gesture. Many of the industrialists had men like this one. Some of them even carried handguns, which was almost unthinkable in Japan. But the right person could make the right sort of approach to the right official, and a very special permit could be issued, and that possibility didn't so much frighten Koga as revolt him. The sword of a Ronin was bad enough, and in this context would merely have been theatrical, but a gun for Koga was pure evil, something that didn't belong in his culture, a coward's weapon. That was what he was dealing with, really. Kaneda was undoubtedly a coward, unable to master his own life, able even to break the law only on orders from others. But with those orders he could do anything. What a dreadful commentary on his country. People like this were used by their masters to strong-arm unions and business competitors. People like Kaneda had assaulted demonstrators, sometimes even in the open, and gotten away with it because the police had looked the other way or managed not to be present, even though reporters and photographers had come to find the scene of the day's interest. People like this and their masters held his country back from true democracy, and the realization was all the more bitter for Koga, because he'd known it for years, dedicated his life to changing it, and failed. And so here he was in Yamata's penthouse apartment under guard, probably to be released some day as the political irrelevance he already was or would soon become, then to watch his country fall totally under the control of a new kind of master, or an old one, he told himself. And not a thing he could do about it, which was why he sat with a book in his hands, while Kaneda sat in front of a TV, watching some actor perform in a drama whose beginning, middle, and end were all foretold 1,000 times, pretending that it was both real and new, when it was neither. Battles like this one had been fought only in simulation, or perhaps in the Roman arenas of a different age. At both ends were the AEW aircraft, E-767s on the Japanese side and E-3Bs on the American, so far apart that neither really saw the other even on the numerous radar screens that both carried, though both monitored the signals of the other on different instruments. In between were the gladiators, because for the third time the Americans were testing the air defenses of Japan and again failing. The American AWACS aircraft were 600 miles off Hokkaido, with the F-22A fighters 100 miles in front of them, trolling, as the flight leader put it, and the Japanese F-15s were coming out as well, entering the radar coverage of the American surveillance aircraft, but not leaving the coverage of their own. On command, the American fighters split into two elements of two aircraft each. The lead element darted due south, using their ability to supercruise at over 900 miles per hour, closing obliquely with the Japanese picket line. "They're fast," a Japanese controller observed. It was hard to hold the contact. The American aircraft was somewhat stealthy, but the size and power of the Kami aircraft's antenna defeated the low-observable technology again, and the controller started vectoring his Eagles south to cover the probe. Just to make sure that the Americans knew they were being tracked, he selected the appropriate blips with his electronic pointer and ordered the radar to steer its beams on them every few seconds and hold them there. They had to know that they were being followed through every move, that their supposedly radar-defeating technology was not good enough for something new and radical. Just to make it a little more interesting, he switched the frequency of his transmitter to fire control mode. They were much too far away, actually, to guide a missile at this range, but even so, it would be one more proof to them that they could be lit up brightly enough for a kill, and that would teach them a lesson of its own. The signal faded a bit at first, almost dropping off entirely, but then the software picked them out of the clutter and firmed up the blip as he jacked up the power down the two azimuths to the American fighters, as fighters they had to be. The B-1, though fast, was not so agile. Yes, this was the best card the Americans had to play, and it was not good enough. And maybe if they learned that, diplomacy would change things once and for all, and the North Pacific Ocean would again be at peace. "See how their Eagles moved to cover?" the senior American controller observed at his supervisory screen. "Like they're tied to the sevens with a string," his companion noted. He was a fighter pilot just arrived from Langley Air Force Base, headquarters of Air Combat Command, where his job was to develop fighter tactics. Another plotting board showed that three of the E-767s were up. Two were on advanced picket duty, while the third was orbiting in close just off the coast of Honshu. That was not unexpected. It was, in fact, the predictable thing to do, because it was also the smart thing to do, and all three surveillance aircraft had their instruments dialed up to what had to be maximum power, as they had to do to detect stealthy aircraft. "Now we know why they hit both the Lancers," the man from Virginia observed. "They can jump to high freaks and illuminate for the Eagles. Our guys never thought they were being shot at." Cute, he thought. Would be nice to have some of those radars, the senior controller agreed. But we know how to beat it now, the officer from Langley thought he saw it. The controller wasn't so sure. We'll know that in another few hours. Sandy Richter was even lower than the C-17 had dared to go. He was also slower at a mere 150 knots, and already tired from the curious mixture of tension and boredom on the overwater flight. The previous night he and the other two aircraft in his flight had staged to Petrovka West, yet another mothballed MiG base near Vladivostok. There they'd gotten what would surely be their last decent sleep for the next few days, and lifted off at 2,200 hours to begin their part in Operation Zorro. Each aircraft now had wing sponsons attached, and on each were two extra fuel tanks, and while they were needed for the range of this flight, they were decidedly unstealthy, even though the tanks themselves had been made out of radar-transparent fiberglass in an effort to improve things a little bit. The pilot was wearing his normal flight gear plus an inflatable life jacket. It was a concession to regulations about flying over water rather than as anything really useful. The water 50 feet below was too cold for long survival. He put the thought aside as best he could, settled into his seat, and concentrated on the flying while the gunner in back handled the instruments. Still okay, Sandy. The threat screen was still more black than anything else as they turned east toward Honshu. Raj, behind them at 10-mile intervals, two more Comanches were heading in. Though small and a mere helicopter, the RAH-66A was in some ways the most sophisticated aircraft in the world. It carried in its composite airframe the two most powerful computers ever taken aloft. And one of them was merely a backup in case the first should break. Their principal task for the moment was to plot the radar coverage that they had to penetrate to compute the relative radar cross-section of their airframe against the known or estimated capabilities of the electronic eyes now sweeping the area. The closer they got to the Japanese mainland, the larger grew the yellow areas of maybe detect and the red areas of definite detect. Phase two, the man from Air Combat Command said quietly aboard the AWACS. The F-22 fighters all carried jamming gear, the better to accentuate their stealth capabilities, and on command these were switched on. Not smart, the Japanese controller thought. Good, they must know that we can track them. His screen was suddenly littered with spots and spokes and flashes as the electronic noise generated by the American fighters muddled his picture. He had two ways of dealing with that. First, he increased his power further. That would burn through much of what the Americans were attempting. Next, he told the radar to start flipping through frequencies at random. The first measure was more effective than the second, he saw, since the American jammers were also frequency agile. It was an imperfect measure, but still a troublesome one. The computer software that was doing the actual tracking was based on assumptions. It started with known or estimate positions of the American aircraft, and knowing their speed range, sought returns that matched their base course and speeds, just as had happened with the bombers that had once probed his defense line. The problem was that at this power output he was again detecting birds and air currents, and picking the actual contacts out was becoming increasingly difficult until he punched yet another button that tracked the jamming emissions that were more powerful than the actual returning signals. With that additional check, he reestablished a firm track on both pairs of targets. It had required only 10 seconds, and that was fast enough. Just to show the Americans he hadn't been fooled, he maxed out his power, flipped briefly to fire control mode, and zapped all four of the American fighters hard enough that if their electronic systems were not properly shielded, the incoming radar signals would burn some of them out. That would be an interesting kill, he thought, and he remembered how a pair of German Tornado fighters had once been destroyed by flying too close to an FM radio tower. To his disappointment, the Americans simply turned away. Somebody just set off Mongo jammers to the northeast. Good, right on time, Richter replied. A quick look at the threat screen showed that he was within minutes of entering a yellow area. He felt the need to rub his face, but both his hands were busy now. A check of the fuel gauges showed that his pylon-mounted tanks were about empty. Punching off the wings. Roger, that'll help. Richter flipped the safety cover off the jettison switch. It was a late addition to the Comanche design, but it had finally occurred to someone that if the chopper was supposed to be stealthy, then it might be a good idea to be able to eliminate the unstealthy features in flight. Richter slowed the aircraft briefly and flipped the toggle that ignited explosive bolts, dumping the wings and their tanks into the Sea of Japan. "Good separation," the backseater confirmed. The threat screen changed as soon as the items were gone. The computer kept careful track of how stealthy the aircraft was. The Comanche's nose dipped again, and the aircraft accelerated back to its cruising speed. "They're predictable, aren't they?" the Japanese controller observed to his chief subordinate. "I think you just proved that. Even better, you just proved to them what we can do." The two officers traded a look. Both had been worried about the capabilities of the American Rapier fighter, and now both thought they could relax about it. A formidable aircraft, and one their Eagle drivers needed to treat with respect, but not invisible. "Predictable response," the American controller said, "and they just showed us something. Call it 10 seconds? Thin, but long enough." "It'll work," the colonel from Langley said, reaching for a coffee. "Now, let's reinforce that idea." On the main screen, the F-22s turned back north, and at the edge of the AWACS detection radius, the F-15Js did the same, covering the American maneuver-like sailboats in attacking duel, striving to stay between the American fighters and their priceless E-767s, which the dreadful accidents of a few days before had made even more precious. Landfall was very welcome indeed. Far more agile than the transport had been the previous night, the Comanche selected a spot completely devoid of human habitation and then started flying down cracks in the mountainous ground, shielded from the distant air surveillance aircraft by solid rock that even their powerful systems could not penetrate. "Feet dry," Richter's backseater said gratefully. 40 minutes of fuel remaining." "You good at flapping your arms?" the pilot inquired, also relaxed, just a little, to be over dry land. If something went wrong, well, eating rice wasn't all that bad, was it? His helmet display showed the ground in green shadows, and there were no lights about from streetlights or cars or houses, and the worst part of the flight-in was over. The actual mission was something he'd managed to set aside. He preferred to worry about only one thing at a time. You live longer that way. The final ridgeline appeared just as programmed. Richter slowed the aircraft, circling to figure out the winds as he looked down for the people he'd been briefed to expect. There. Somebody tossed out a green chemlight, and in his low-light vision systems, it looked as bright as a full moon. "Zorro lead calling Zorro base, over." "Lead, this is base. Authentication, Golf Mike Zulu, over," the voice replied, giving the okay code he'd been briefed to expect. Richter hoped the voice didn't have a gun to its head. "Copy. Out." He spiraled down quickly, flaring his Comanche and settling on what happened to be an almost flat spot close to the tree line. As soon as the aircraft touched down, 3 men appeared from the trees. They were dressed like U.S. Army soldiers, and Richter allowed himself a chance to breathe as he cooled off the engines prior to shutdown. The rotor had not yet completed its final revolution before a hose came out to the aircraft's fuel connection. "Welcome to Japan. I'm Captain Cheka," Sandy Richter, the pilot said, climbing out. "Any problems coming in?" "Not anymore. Hell, I got here, didn't I?" he wanted to say, still tense from the 3-hour marathon to invade the country. "Invade? 11 Rangers and 6 aviators. Hey," he thought. "You're all under arrest." "There's number 2, Cheka observed. "Quiet babies, aren't they?" "We don't want to advertise, sir." It was perhaps the most surprising aspect of the Comanche. The Sikorsky engineers had long known that most of the noise generated by a helicopter came from the tail rotor's conflict with the main. The one on the RAH-66 was shrouded, and the main rotor had 5 fairly thick composite blades, resulting in a helicopter with less than a third of the acoustical signature of any other rotary wing aircraft yet built. And the area wouldn't hurt, Richter thought, looking around. All the trees, the thin mountain air, Not a bad place for the mission, he concluded, as the second Comanche settled down on its landing pad 50 meters away. The men who had fueled his aircraft were already stringing camouflage netting over it using poles cut from the pine forest. Come on, let's get some food in you. Real food or MREs? The chief warrant officer asked. You can't have everything, Mr. Richter, Cheka told him. The aviator remembered when Army sea rations had also included cigarettes, no longer, what with the new healthy Army, and there wasn't much sense in asking a ranger for a smoke. Damned athletes. The Rapiers turned away an hour later, convinced the Japanese air defense people were sure that they could not penetrate the Kami Eagle line that guarded the northeast approaches to the home islands. Even the best American aircraft and best systems could not defeat what they had to face, and that was good. On their screens they watched the contacts fade off, and soon the emissions from the E-3Bs faded as well, heading back to Shemya to report their failure to their masters. The Americans were realists, courageous warriors to be sure. The officers in the E-767s would not make the mistake, as their forebears had, of thinking that Americans lacked the ardor for real combat operations. That error had been a costly one. But war was a technical exercise, and they had allowed their strength to fall below a line from which recovery was not technically possible. And that was too bad for them. The Rapiers had to tank on the way back and didn't use their supercruise ability because wasting fuel was not purposeful. The weather was again crummy at Shemya, and the fighters rode down under positive ground control to their safe landings, then taxied off to their hangars, which were more crowded now, with the arrival of 4 F-15E Strike Eagles from Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho. They also regarded the mission as a success. Chapter 42, Lightning Strikes. Are you mad? Cherenko asked. Think about it, Clark said again back in the Russian embassy. We want a political solution to this, don't we? Then Koga's our best chance. You told us the government didn't put him in the bag. Who does that leave? He's probably right there. You could even see the building out Cherenko's window, as luck would have it. Is it possible? The Russian asked, worried that the Americans would ask for assistance that he was quite unsuited to provide. There's a risk, but it's unlikely he has an army up there. He wouldn't be keeping the guy there unless he wanted to be covert about it. Figure 5 or 6 people max. And 2 of you, Cherenko insisted. Like the man said, Ding offered with a very showy smile. No big deal. So the old KGB file was true. Clark was not a real intelligence officer, but a paramilitary type, and the same was true of his arrogant young partner, who mostly just sat there looking out the window. I can offer you nothing by way of assistance. How about weapons? Clark asked. You're going to tell me you don't have anything here we can use? What kind of residentura is this? Clark knew that the Russian would have to temporize. Too bad that these people weren't trained to take much initiative. I need permission before I can do any of that. Clark nodded, congratulating himself on making a good guess. He opened his laptop computer. So do we. You get yours, I'll get mine. Jones stubbed out his cigarette in the Navy-style aluminum ashtray. The pack had been stuck away in a desk drawer, perhaps in anticipation of just such an occasion as this. When a war started, the peacetime rules went out the window. Old habits, especially bad ones, were easy to fall back into. But then that's what war was, too, wasn't it? He could also see that Admiral Mancuso was wavering on the edge of bumming one, and so he made sure the butt was all the way out. What do you have, Ron? You take the time to work this gear, and you get results. Boomer and me have been tweaking the data all week. We started on the surface ships. Jones walked to the wall chart. We've been plotting the position of the cans. All the way from... Captain Chambers interrupted, only to be cut off. Yes, sir, all the way from mid-pack. I've been playing in broadband and narrowband and checking weather, and I've plotted them. Jones pointed at the silhouettes pinned to the map. That's fine, Ron, but we have satellite overheads for that, ComSub Pack pointed out. So, am I right? The civilian asked. Pretty close, Mancuso admitted. Then he pointed to the other shapes pinned to the wall. Yeah, that's right, Bart. Once I figured how to track the cans, then we started working on the submarines. And guess what? I can still bag the fuckers when they snort. Here's your picket line. We get them about a third of the time by reckoning, and the bearings are fairly constant. The wall chart showed six firm contacts. Those silhouettes were within circles between 20 and 30 miles in diameter. Two more were overlaid with question marks. That still leaves a few unaccounted for, Chambers noted. Jones nodded. True, but I got six for sure, maybe eight. We can't get good cuts off the Japanese coast, just too far. I'm plotting merchantmen shuttling back and forth to the islands, but that's all, he admitted. I'm also tracking a big two-screw contact heading west toward the Marshalls, and I kind of noticed that there's an empty dry dock across the way this morning. That's secret, Mancuso pointed out with a quiet smile. Well, if I were you guys, I'd tell Stennis to watch out for this line of SSKs, gentlemen. You might want to let the subs head into the briar patch first to clean things out, like. We can do that, but I'm worried about the others, Chambers admitted. Con, sonar. Con I, Lieutenant Ken Shaw had the midwatch. Possible sonar contact bearing 060, probably a submerged contact. Very faint, sir, the sonar chief reported. The drill was automatic after all the practice they'd undergone on the trips from Bremerton and Pearl. The fire control tracking party immediately started a plot. A tech on the ray path analyzer took data directly from the sonar instruments and from that tried to determine the probable range to the target. The computer required only a second. That's a direct path signal, sir. Range is under 20,000 yards. Dutch Claggett hadn't really been asleep. In the way of captains, he'd been lying in his bunk, eyes closed, even dreaming something meaningless and confusing about a day fishing on the beach, with the fish behind him on the sand and creeping closer to his back when the call had gone out from sonar. Somehow he'd come completely awake and was now in the attack center, standing barefoot in his underwear. He checked the room to determine depth, course, and speed, then headed into sonar to get his own look at the instruments. "Talk to me, Chief." "Right here on the 60 hertz line." The chief tapped the screen with his grease pencil. It came and went and came and went, but kept coming back, just a series of dots trickling down the screen, all on the same frequency line. The bearing was changing slowly right to left. "They've been at sea for more than 3 weeks," Claggett thought aloud. "Long time for a diesel boat," the chief agreed. "Maybe heading back in for refueling?" Claggett leaned in closer, as though proximity to the screen would make a difference. "Could be, or maybe he's just changing position. Makes sense that they'd have a patrol line offshore. Keep me posted." "Aye, Captain." "Well," Claggett asked the tracking party. "First cut on range is 14,000 yards. Base course is westerly, speed about 6 knots. The contact was easily within range of his ADCAP torpedoes, Claggett saw, but the mission didn't allow him to do anything about it. Wasn't that just great? "Let's get two weapons warmed up," the captain said. "When we have a good track on our friend, we evade to the south. If he closes on us, we try to keep out of his way, and we can shoot only if there's no choice." He didn't even have to look around to know what his crewman thought of that. He could hear the change in how they breathed. "What do you think?" Mary Pat Foley asked. "Interesting," Jack said after a moment's contemplation of the facts from Langley. "It's a long ball opportunity," this was the voice of Ed Foley, "but it's one hell of a gamble." "They're not even sure he's there," Ryan said, rereading the signal. It bore all the marks of something from John Clark, honest, decisive, positive. The man knew how to think on his feet, and though often a guy at the bottom of the food chain, he tended to see the big picture very clearly from down there. "I have to go upstairs with this one, guys." "Don't trip on the way," MP advised with a smile he could almost hear. She was still a cowgirl on field operations. "I recommend a go mission on this one." "And you, Ed?" Jack asked. "It's a risk, but sometimes you go with what the guy in the field says. If we want a political resolution for this situation, well, then we have to have a tame political figure to lean on. We need the guy, and this might be our only way to get him out alive. The National Security Advisor could hear the gritted teeth on the other end of the Stu 6 circuit. Both the Foleys were true to form. More importantly, they were in agreement. I'll be back to you in 20 minutes. Ryan switched over to his regular phone. I need to see the boss right now, he told the president's executive secretary. The sun was rising for yet another hot, windless day. Admiral Dubrow realized that he was losing weight. The waistband on his khaki trousers was looser than usual, and he had to reef in his belt a little more. His two carriers were now in regular contact with the Indians. Sometimes they came close enough for a visual, though more often some Harriers looked down radar just took a snapshot from 50 or so miles away. Worse, his orders were to let them see his ships. Why the hell wasn't he heading east for the Straits of Malacca? There was a real war to fight. He'd come to regard the possible Indian invasion of Sri Lanka as a personal insult, but Sri Lanka wasn't U.S. territory, and the Marianas were, and his were the only carriers Dave Seaton had. Okay, so the approach wouldn't exactly be covert. He had to pass through one of several straits to re-enter the Pacific Ocean, all of them about as busy as Times Square at noon. There was even the off chance of a sub there, but he had ASW ships, and he could pounce on any submarine that tried to hinder his passage. But his orders were to remain in the I.O. and to be seen doing so. The word was out among the crew, of course. He hadn't made even a token effort to keep things quiet. It would never have worked in any case, and his people had a right to know what was going on in anticipation of entering the fray. They needed to know, to get their backs up, to generate an extra determination before shifting from a peacetime mentality to that of a shooting war. But once you were ready, you had to do it. And they weren't. The result was the same for him as for every other man or woman in the battle force. Searing frustration, short temper, and a building rage. The day before, one of his Tomcat drivers had blown between two Indian Harriers, with perhaps 10 feet of separation, just to show them who knew how to fly and who didn't, and while that had probably put the fear of God into the visitors, it wasn't terribly professional. Even though Mike Dubrow could remember what it was like to be a lieutenant junior grade, and could also imagine himself doing the same thing. That hadn't made the personal dressing down any easier. He'd had to do it, and had also known afterward that the flight crew in question would go back to their quarters muttering about the dumb old fart on the flag bridge who didn't know what it was like to drive fighter planes, 'cause the Spads he'd grown up with had probably used wind-up keys to get off the boat. "If they take the first shot, we're going to get hurt," Commander Harrison observed after announcing that their dawn patrol had shown up right on schedule. "If they put an exocet into us, we'll pipe sweepers, man your brooms, Ed." It was a lame attempt at humor, but Dubrow didn't feel very humorous at the moment. "Not if they get lucky and catch a JP bunker." Now his operations officer was turning pessimistic. Not good, the battle force commander thought. "Show 'em we care," Dubrow ordered. A few moments later, the screening ships lit off their fire-controlled radars and locked on to the Indian intruders. Through his binoculars, Dubrow could see that the nearest Aegis cruiser had white missiles sitting in her launch rails, and then they trained out, as did the target illumination radars. The message was clear. Keep away. He could have ordered another wrathful dispatch to Pearl Harbor, but Dave Seaton had enough on his plate, and the real decisions were being made in Washington by people who didn't understand the problem. "Is it worth doing?" "Yes, sir," Ryan replied, having come to his own conclusion on the walk to the president's office. It meant putting two friends at additional risk, but that was their job, and making the decision was his, partly anyway. It was easy to say such things, even knowing that because of them he'd sleep badly, if at all. The reasons are obvious. "And if it fails, two of our people are in grave danger, but that's what they're for?" Durling asked, not entirely kindly. "They're both friends of mine, Mr. President. If you think I like the idea of..." "Settle down," the president said. "We have a lot of people at risk, and you know what? Not knowing who they are makes it harder instead of easier. I've learned that one the hard way. Roger Durling looked down at his desk, at all the administrative briefing papers and other matters that didn't have the first connection to the crisis in the Pacific, but had to be handled nonetheless. The government of the United States of America was a huge business, and he couldn't ignore any of it, no matter how important some area might have suddenly become. Did Ryan understand that? Jack saw the papers, too. He didn't have to know what they were exactly. None had classified cover sheets on them. They were the ordinary day-to-day crap that the man had to deal with. The boss had to timeshare his brain with so many tasks. It hardly seemed fair, especially for someone who hadn't exactly gone looking for the job. But that was destiny at work, and Durling had voluntarily undertaken the vice president's office because his character required service to others, as indeed did Ryan's. They really were two of a kind, Jack thought. Mr. President, I'm sorry I said that. Yes, sir, I have considered the risks, but also, yes, that is their job. Moreover, it's John's recommendation. His idea, I mean. He's a good field officer, and he knows both the risks and the potential rewards. Mary Pat and Ed agree, and also recommend a go on this one. The decision necessarily is yours to make, but those are the recommendations. Are we grasping at straws? Durling wanted to know. Not a straw, sir. Potentially a very strong branch. I hope they're careful about it. Oh, this is just great, Chavez observed. The Russian PSM automatic pistol was of .215 caliber, smaller in diameter even than the .22 rimfire that American kids, at least the politically incorrect ones, learned to shoot at Boy Scout camps. It was also the standard sidearm of the Russian military and police forces, which perhaps explained why the Russian criminal element had such contempt for the local cops. "Well, we do have our secret weapon out in the car," Clark said, hefting the gun in his hand. And at least the silencer improved its balance somewhat. It was renewed proof of something he'd thought for years. Europeans didn't know beans about handguns. We're going to need it, too. The Russian embassy did have a pistol range for its security officers. Chavez clipped a target to the rack and cranked it down range. Take the suppressor off, John said. Why? Ding said. Look at it. Chavez did, and saw that the Russian version was filled with steel wool. It's only good for 5 or 6 shots. The range did have ear protectors, at least. Clark filled a magazine with 8 of the bottlenecked rounds, pointed downrange, and fired off 3 shots. The gun was quite noisy, its high-powdered cartridge driving a tiny bullet at warp speed. He longed for a suppressed .22 automatic. Well, at least it was accurate. Cherenko watched in silence, angered at the Americans' distaste for his country's weapons and embarrassed because they might well be right. He'd learned to shoot ears before and hadn't shown much aptitude for it. It was a skill rarely used by an intelligence officer, Hollywood movies notwithstanding. But it was clearly not true of the Americans, both of whom were hitting the bullseye 5 meters away, firing pairs of shots called double taps in the business. Finished, Clark cleared his weapon, reloaded a magazine, and took another, which he filled, and slid into a back pocket. Chavez did the same. "If you ever come to Washington," Ding observed, "we'll show you what we use." "And the secret weapon you mentioned?" Cherenko asked the senior man. "It's a secret." Clark headed for the door, with Chavez in his wake. They had all day to wait for their chance, if that was what it was, and get their nerves even more frayed. It was a characteristically stormy day at Shemya. Sleet, driven by a 50-knot gale, pelted the base's single runway, and the noise threatened to disturb the sleep of the fighter pilots. Inside the hangars, the 8 fighter aircraft were crammed together to protect them from the elements. It was especially necessary for the F-22s, as no one had yet fully determined what damage the elements could do to their smooth surfaces, and thus the radar cross-section. This was not the time to find out. The storm's precipitation should pass in a few hours, the weather weenies said, though the gale-force winds could well last another month. Outside, the ground crews worried about the tie-downs on the tanker and AWACS birds and struggled around in bulky cold weather gear to make certain everything was secure. The other aspects of base security were handled at the Cobra Dane array. Though it looked like the screen from an old drive-in theater, it was in fact a massive version of the solid-state radar array used by the Japanese E-767s, or for that matter the Aegis cruisers and destroyers in both contending navies. Originally emplaced to monitor Soviet missile tests and later to do SDI research, it was powerful enough to scan thousands of miles into space and hundreds in the atmosphere. Its electronic probes swept constantly now, searching for intruders, but so far finding only commercial airliners, but those were watched very closely indeed. An F-15E Strike Eagle loaded with air-to-air missiles could be sent aloft in 10 minutes if one of them looked the least bit dangerous. The dreary routine continued through the day. For a brief few hours there was enough gray illumination through the clouds to suggest that the sun might be up in a theoretical sense, but by the time the pilots were roused, the view out the windows of their quarters might as well have been painted black, for even the runway lights were out lest they give some unwelcome visitor a visual aid in finding the base through the gloom. Questions. The operation had been planned rapidly but carefully, and the four lead pilots had taken a hand in it, then tested it the night before. And while there were risks, well, hell, there always were. "You Eagle Jocks think you can handle this?" the most senior Rapier driver asked. He was a lieutenant colonel, which didn't protect him from the reply. "Don't worry, sir," a major said. "It's such a nice ass to look at." Then she blew a kiss. The colonel, actually an engineering test pilot, pulled away from developmental work underway on the F-22 with the 57th Weapons Wing at Nellis Air Force Base, knew the old Air Force only from the movies and stories he'd heard when he'd been a youngster coming up the line. But he took the insult in the spirit in which it had been offered. The Strike Eagles might not be stealthy, but they were pretty damn mean. They were about to engage in a combat mission, and rank didn't matter as much as competence and confidence. "Okay, people," once he would have just said, "men. We're time critical on this one. Let's get it on." The tanker crews chuckled to themselves about the fighter jock mentality and how the women in the Air Force had really bought into it. The major was a dish, one of them thought. Maybe when she grew up she could come and fly United, he observed, to the captain who'd be right seating for him. A man could do worse, the Southwest Airlines first officer noted. The tankers got off 20 minutes later, followed by one of the E-3Bs. The fighters typically went off last. The crews all wore their cold-weather Nomex flight suits and made the proper gestures about survival gear, which was really a joke over the North Pacific this time of year. But rules were rules. G-suits went on last of all, uncomfortable and restrictive as they were. One by one, the Rapier drivers walked to their birds, the Eagle crews two by two. The colonel who'd lead the mission ostentatiously tore off the Velcro Rapier patch and replaced it with the counterculture one Lockheed employees had made up, the silhouette of the original P-38 Lightning overlaid with the graceful profile of the company's newest steed and further decorated with a white-yellow thunderbolt. Tradition, after all, the colonel thought, even though he hadn't been born until the last of the twin-boom 38s had been sold to the strippers. He did remember building models of the first American long-range fighter, used only one time for their actual designed purpose, for which a driver named Tex Lamphere had won a little immortality. This one would not be terribly different from that day over the Northern Solomons. The fighters had to be towed out into the open, and even before they started engines, every crew member could feel the wind buffeting the fighters. It was the time when the fingers tingle on the controls and the pilots shift around a little in the seats to make everything just so. Then, one by one, the fighters lit off and taxied down to the runway's edge. The lights came back on, blue parallel lines stretching off into the gloom, and the fighters lifted off singly, a minute apart, because paired takeoffs in these weather conditions were too dangerous, and this wasn't a night for unnecessary mistakes. 3 minutes later, the two flights of four formed up over the top of the clouds where the weather was clear, with bright stars and the multicolored aurora to their right, curtains of changing colors, greens and purples as the stellar wind affected charged particles in the upper atmosphere. The curtain effect was both lovely and symbolic to the Lightning pilots. The first hour was routine, the two quartets of aircraft cruising southwest, their anti-collision lights blinking away to give visual warning of the close proximity. System checks were performed, instruments monitored, and stomachs settled as they approached the tanker aircraft. The tanker crews, old reservists who flew airliners in civilian life, had taken care to locate smooth weather areas which the fighter drivers appreciated, even though they deemed everyone else second best. It took more than 40 minutes to top off everyone's fuel tanks, and then the tankers resumed their orbit, probably so that their crews could catch up on their Wall Street journals, the fighter pilots all thought, heading southwest again. Things changed now. It was time for business. Their kind. Sandy Richter drew the mission, of course, because it had been his idea from the start, months before at Nellis Air Force Base. It had worked there, and all he had to figure out was whether it would work here as well. On that, he was probably betting his life. Richter had been in that business since he was 17, when he'd lied about his age and gotten away with it, being large and tough. Along the way, he'd corrected his official package, but he was still in his 29th year of service and soon to retire to a quieter life. All that time, Richter had driven snakes and only snakes. If a helicopter didn't carry weapons, then he wasn't interested. Starting with the AH-1 Huey Cobra, he had in time graduated to the AH-64 Apache and driven it into his second, briefer war in the skies over the Arabian Peninsula. Now, this was the last bird he would ever fly. He started the engines on the Comanche and began his 6,751st hour of flight, according to the logbook. The twin turboshaft engine spun up normally, and the rotor began its rotation. The ersatz ground crew of Rangers were hamming it up with the one fire extinguisher they had. It was about large enough to put out a cigarette. Richter thought crossly as he increased power and lifted off. The thin mountain air had a negative effect on performance, but not that much, and he'd soon be down at sea level anyway. The pilot gave his head the usual shake to make sure the helmet was securely in place and headed eastward, tracing up the wooded slopes of Shiraishi-san. "There they are," the lead 22 pilot said to himself. The first sign was chirping in his headset, immediately followed by information on his threat receiver. Air defense radar, airborne, type J, bearing 213. Next came data linked over from the E-3B, which had been in place long enough to plot its location. The sentry wasn't using its radar at all tonight. After all, the Japanese had taught the Americans a lesson the night before, and they needed time to absorb such lessons. Range to target 1, 456 miles. Still, well under the horizon from the Japanese aircraft, he gave his first vocal command of the mission. Lightning lead to flight split into elements now. Instantly, the two sets of four aircraft divided into pairs, separated by 2,000 yards. In both cases, the F-22s held the lead, and in both cases, the trailing F-15Es tucked in dangerously close to create a radar overlap. The colonel in command flew as straight and level as his practiced skills allowed, and he smiled to himself at the memory of the major's remark. "Nice ass, eh?" She was the first woman to fly with the Thunderbirds. Strobe lights went off, and he hoped that the low light gear she was wearing was working properly. The northern E-767 was now 400 miles away. The fighters cruised in at 500 knots, altitude 35,000 feet for fuel economy. The work schedule typical of Japanese executives made the entry less obvious than would have been the case in America. A man was in the lobby, but he was watching TV, and Clark and Chavez walked through as though they knew where they were going, and crime was not a problem in Tokyo anyway. Breathing a little rapidly, they got into an elevator and punched a button, trading a relieved look that soon changed to renewed apprehension. Ding was carrying his briefcase, Clark was not, and both were dressed in their best suits and ties and white shirts, looking for all the world like business people coming in for a late night's conference on something or other. The elevator stopped 5 floors from the top, a level selected because of the lack of lights in the windows. Clark stuck his head out, knowing that it looked vaguely criminal to do so, but the corridor was empty. They moved quickly and quietly around the central bearing core of the building, found the fire stairs, and started to climb. They looked for security cameras, and again, thankfully, there were none on this level. Clark checked up and down. No one else was in the stairwell. He continued to head up, looking and listening before every movement. "Our friends are back," one of the airborne controllers announced over the intercom. "Bearing 033, range 420 kilometers. 2 contacts. Close formation. Military aircraft inbound, speed 500 knots," he concluded the announcement rapidly. "Very well," the senior controller responded evenly, selecting the display for his screen as he switched channels on his command phones. "Any radar activity to the northeast?" "None," the electronic countermeasures officer replied at once. "He could be out there monitoring us, of course." "Okerimas." The next order of business was to release the two fighters orbiting east of the Kami aircraft. Both F-15Js had recently arrived on station and had nearly full fuel tanks. An additional call ordered two more up from Shitozi Air Base. They would need about 15 minutes to get on station, but that was fine, the senior controller thought. He had the time. "Lock onto them," he ordered the operator. "Got us all ready, do you?" the colonel asked himself. "Good." He held course and speed, wanting them to get a good feel for his location and activities. The rest was mainly a matter of arithmetic. Figure the Eagles were now about 200 miles away, closing speed about 1,000, 6 minutes to separation. He checked his clock and commanded his eyes to sweep the skies for something a little too bright to be a star. There was a camera on the top level of the stairs, so Yamata was a little paranoid. But even paranoids had enemies, Clark thought, noticing that the body of the camera appeared to be pointed at the next landing. 10 steps to the landing and 10 more to the next, where the door was. He decided to take a moment to think about that. Chavez turned the knob on the door to his right. It didn't appear to be locked. Probably fire codes, Clark thought, acknowledging the information with a nod, but getting out his burglar tools anyway. "Well, what do you think?" "I think I'd rather be somewhere else." Ding had his light in his hand as John took his pistol out and screwed the suppressor in place. "Fast or slow?" That was the only remaining choice, really. A slow approach, like people on regular business. Lost, perhaps. No, not this time. Clark held up one finger, took a deep breath, and bounded upwards. 4 seconds later, he twisted the knob at the top landing and flung the door open. John dove to the floor, his pistol out, and, training in on the target, Ding jumped past him, stood and aimed his own weapon. The guard outside the door had been looking the other way when the stairway entrance swung open. He turned in automatic alarm and saw a large man lying sideways on the floor and possibly aiming a gun at him. That caused him to reach for his own as his eyes locked on the potential targets. There was a second man holding something else that... At this range, the light had almost a physical force. The 3 million candles of energy turned the entire world into the face of the sun. And then the energy overload invaded the man's central nervous system along the trigeminal nerve, which runs from the back of the eye along the base of the brain, branching out through the neural network that controls the voluntary muscles. The effect, as in Africa, was to overload the guard's nervous system. He fell to the floor like a rag doll, his twitching right hand still grasping a pistol. The light was sufficiently bright that reflection from the white-painted walls dazzled Chavez slightly, but Clark had remembered to shut his eyes and raced for the double doors, which he drove apart with his shoulder. One man was in view, just getting up from a chair in front of the TV, his face surprised and alarmed at the unannounced entry. There wasn't time for mercy. Clark brought the gun up in both hands and squeezed twice, both shots entering the man's forehead. John felt Ding's hand on his shoulder, which allowed him to move right, almost running now, down a hallway, looking into each room. "Kitchen," he thought. "You always found people in the..." He did. This man was almost his height, and his gun was already out as he moved for the hallway that led to the foyer, calling out a name and a question, but he, too, was a little slow, and his gun was still down, and he met a man with his pistol up and ready. It was the last thing he would ever see. Clark needed another half a minute to check out the rest of the luxury apartment, but found only empty rooms. "Yevgeny Pavlovich," he called. "Vanya, this way." Clark moved back left, taking a quick look at both of the men he'd killed as he did so, just to make sure, really. He knew that he'd remember these bodies as he did all the others, knew that they'd come back to him, and he tried to explain away their deaths as he always did. Koga was sitting there, remarkably pale, as Chavez/Chekhov finished checking out the room. The guy in front of the TV hadn't managed to clear the pistol from his shoulder holster, probably an idea he'd gotten from a movie, Clark thought. The things were damn near useless if you needed your weapon in a hurry. "Clear to left," Chavez said, remembering to speak in Russian. "Clear right," Clark commanded himself to calm down, looking at the guy by the TV, wondering which of the people they'd killed had been responsible for the death of Kim Norton. Well, probably not the one outside. "Who are you?" Koga demanded with a mixture of shock and anger, not quite remembering that they'd met before. Clark took a breath before answering. "Koga-san, we are the people who are rescuing you." "You killed them," the man pointed with a shaking hand. "We can speak about that later, perhaps. Will you come with us, please? You are not in danger from us, sir." Koga wasn't inhuman. Clark admired his concern for the dead men, even though they had clearly not been his friends, but it was time to get him the hell out of here. "Which one was Kaneda?" Chavez asked. The former Prime Minister pointed to the one in the room. Ding walked over for a last look and managed not to say anything, before directing his eyes to Clark, his expression, one that only the two could possibly understand. "Vanya, time to leave." His threat receiver was going slightly nuts. The screen was all reds and yellows, and the female voice was telling him that he'd been detected. But in this case, he knew better than the computer did, Richter thought, and it was nice to know that the goddamn thing didn't quite get everything right. Just the flying part was hard enough, and though the Apache might have had the agility for the mission, it was better to be in the RAH-66. His body displayed no obvious tension. Years of practice allowed him to sit comfortably in the armored seat, his right forearm resting on the space provided while his hand worked the side-stick controller. His head traced regularly around the sky, and his eyes automatically compared the real horizon with the one generated by the sensing gear located in the aircraft's nose. The Tokyo skyline was just perfect for what he was doing. The various buildings had to be generating all manner of confusing signals for the radar aircraft he was closing on, and the best of computer systems could not defeat this sort of clutter. Better yet, he had the time to do it right. The River Tone would take him most of the way he needed to go, and on the south side of the river was a rail line, and on the rail line was a train that would go all the way to Choshi. The train was cruising at over 100 knots, and he took position right over it, one eye on the train below, while another kept track of a moving indicator on his threat receiver display. He held 100 feet over the tops of the catenary towers, pacing the train exactly, just over the last car in the consist. "That's funny," the operator on Kami 2 noticed a blip enhanced by the computer systems closing in on the position of his aircraft. He keyed the intercom for the senior controller. "Possible low-level inbound," he reported, highlighting the contact and cross-loading it for the crew member. "It's a train," the man replied at once, comparing the location with a map overlay. "The problem with flying these damn things too close to land. The standard discrimination software originally purchased from the Americans had been modified, but not in all details. The airborne raider could track anything that moved, but there wasn't enough computer power in all the world to classify and display all the contacts that would develop from cars and trucks moving on the highways under the aircraft. To declutter the screens, nothing going slower than 150 kilometers per hour was passed through the computer filtering system. But over land, even that was not good enough, not over the country with the world's finest trains." Just to be sure, the senior officer watched the blip for a few seconds. Yes, it was following the main line from Tokyo to Choshi. It couldn't possibly be a jet aircraft. A helicopter, theoretically, could do something like this, but from the weak character of the signal, it was probably just scatter off the metal roof of the train and probably reflection off the catenary towers. "Adjust your MTI discriminator to 200, he ordered his people. It took 3 seconds for all of them to do that, and sure enough, that moving blip by the Tone and two other more obvious ground contacts disappeared. They had more interesting things to do, since two was cross-loading the take from Commies 4 and 6 and then downloading it to the Air Defense HQ just outside Tokyo. The Americans were probing their defenses again, and probably again with their advanced F-22s trying to see if they could defeat the Commies. Well, this time the reception wouldn't be quite so friendly. 8 F-15 Eagle interceptors were up now.